A certain captain in the French army advised the French king, who was by no means cheerful, not to begin the battle until the morrow. The king, taking this advice, gave the word to halt. But, those behind not understanding it, or desiring to be foremost with the rest, came pressing on. The roads for a great distance were covered with this immense army, and with the common people from the villages, who were flourishing their rude weapons, and making a great noise. Owing to these circumstances, the French army advanced in the greatest confusion, every French lord doing what he liked with his own men, and putting out the men of every other French lord. Now, their king relied strongly upon a great body of crossbowmen from Genoa, and these he ordered to the front to begin the battle, on finding that he could not stop it. They shouted once, they shouted twice, they shouted three times, to alarm the English archers, but, the English would have heard them shout 3,000 times and would have never moved. At last the crossbowmen went forward a little, and began to discharge their bolts, upon which, the English let fly such a hail of arrows, that the Genoese speedily made offer for their crossbows, besides being heavy to carry, required to be wound up with a handle, and consequently took time to reload. The English, on the other hand, could discharge their arrows almost as fast as the arrows could fly. When the French king saw the Genoese turning, he cried out to his men to kill those scoundrels, who were doing harm instead of service. This increased the confusion. Meanwhile the English archers, continuing to shoot as fast as ever, shot down great numbers of the French soldiers and knights, whom certain sly Cornish men and Welshmen, from the English army, creeping along the ground, dispatched with great knives. The prince and his division were at this time so hard pressed, that the Earl of Warwick sent a message to the king, who was overlooking the battle from a windmill, beseeching him to send more aid. "Is my son killed?" "Atm," said the king. "And no, sire, please God, Atm," returned the messenger. "Is he wounded?" "Atm," said the king. "And no, sire. Atm, is he thrown to the ground?" "Atm," said the king. "And no, sire, not so, but, he is very hard pressed. Atm, then, Atm," said the king. "Go back to those who sent you, and tell them I shall send no aid, because I set my heart upon my son proving himself this day a brave knight, and because I am resolved, please God, that the honor of a great victory shall be his." Atm, these bold words, being reported to the prince and his division, so raised their spirits, that they fought better than ever. The king of France charged gallantly with his men many times, but it was of no use. Night closing in, his horse was killed under him by an English arrow, and the knights and nobles who had clustered thick about him early in the day, were now completely scattered. At last, some of his few remaining followers led him off the field by force, since he would not retire of himself, and they journeyed away to Amiens. The victorious English, lighting their watch fires, made merry on the field, and the king, riding to meet his gallant son, took him in his arms, kissed him, and told him that he had acted nobly, and proved himself worthy of the day and of the crown. While it was yet night, King Edward was hardly aware of the great victory he had gained, but, next day, it was discovered that 11 princes, 1,200 knights, and 30,000 common men lay dead upon the French side. Among these was the King of Bohemia, an old blind man, who, having been told that his son was wounded in the battle, and that no force could stand against the Black Prince, called to him two knights, put himself on horseback between them, fastened the three bridles together, and dashed in among the English, where he was presently slain. He bore as his crest three white ostrich feathers, with the motto "Ic Dien," signifying in English "I serve." Atm. This crest and motto were taken by the Prince of Wales in remembrance of that famous day, and have been borne by the Prince of Wales ever since. 5 days after this great battle, the king laid siege to Calais. This siege ever afterwards memorably lasted nearly a year. In order to starve the inhabitants out, King Edward built so many wooden houses for the lodgings of his troops, that it is said their quarters looked like a second Calais suddenly sprung around the first. Early in the siege, the governor of the town drove out what he called the useless mouths, to the number of 1,700 persons, men and women, young and old. King Edward allowed them to pass through his lines, and even fed them, and dismissed them with money, but, later in the siege, he was not so merciful. A 500 more, who were afterwards driven out, dying of starvation and misery. The garrison were so hard pressed at last, that they sent a letter to King Philip, telling him that they had eaten all the horses, all the dogs, and all the rats and mice that could be found in the place, and, that if he did not relieve them, they must either surrender to the English, or eat one another. Philip made one effort to give them relief, but they were so hemmed in by the English power, that he could not succeed, and was fain to leave the place. Upon this they hoisted the English flag, and surrendered to King Edward. "I tell your general, A.T.M.," said he to the humble messengers who came out of the town, "that I require to have sent here, 6 of the most distinguished citizens, bare-legged, and in their shirts, with ropes about their necks, and let those 6 men bring with them the keys of the castle and the town." A.T.M. When the governor of Calais related this to the people in the marketplace, there was great weeping and distress, in the midst of which, one worthy citizen, named Eustace de Saint-Pierre, rose up and said, that if the 6 men required were not sacrificed, the whole population would be. Therefore, he offered himself as the first. Encouraged by this bright example, 5 other worthy citizens rose up one after another, and offered themselves to save the rest. The governor, who was too badly wounded to be able to walk, mounted a poor old horse that had not been eaten, and conducted these good men to the gate, while all the people cried and mourned. Edward received them wrathfully, and ordered the heads of the whole 6 to be struck off. However, the good queen fell upon her knees, and besought the king to give them up to her. The king replied, "I wish you had been somewhere else, but I cannot refuse you." A.T.M. So she had them properly dressed, made a feast for them, and sent them back with a handsome present, to the great rejoicing of the whole camp. I hope the people of Calais loved the daughter to whom she gave birth soon afterwards, for her gentle mother A.T.M.'s sake. Now came the terrible disease, the plague, into Europe, hurrying from the heart of China, and killed the wretched people, especially the poorer, in such enormous numbers, that 1/2 of the inhabitants of England are related to have died of it. It killed the cattle, in great numbers, too, and so few working men remained alive, that there were not enough left to till the ground. After 8 years of differing and quarrelling, the Prince of Wales again invaded France with an army of 60,000 men. He went through the south of the country, burning and plundering wheresoever he went, while his father, who had still the Scottish War upon his hands, did the like in Scotland, but was harassed and worried in his retreat from that country by the Scottish men, who repaid his cruelties with interest. The French king, Philip, was now dead, and was succeeded by his son John. The Black Prince, called by that name from the colour of the armour he wore to set off his fair complexion, continuing to burn and destroy in France, roused John into determined opposition, and so cruel had the Black Prince been in his campaign, and so severely had the French peasants suffered, that he could not find one who, for love, or money, or the fear of death, would tell him what the French king was doing, or where he was. Thus it happened that he came upon the French king A.T.M.'s forces, all of a sudden, near the town of Poitiers, and found that the whole neighbouring country was occupied by a vast French army. God help us! A.T.M. said the Black Prince, we must make the best of it. A.T.M. So, on a Sunday morning, the 18th of September, the prince, whose army was now reduced to 10,000 men in Ala, prepared to give battle to the French king, who had 60,000 horse alone. While he was so engaged, there came riding from the French camp a cardinal, who had persuaded John to let him offer terms, and try to save the shedding of Christian blood. "I save my honor, A.T.M. said the prince to this good priest, and save the honor of my army, and I will make any reasonable terms." A.T.M. he offered to give up all the towns, castles, and prisoners he had taken, and to swear to make no war in France for 7 years, but, as John would hear of nothing but his surrender, with 100 of his chief knights, the treaty was broken off, and the prince said quietly, "May God defend the right, we shall fight tomorrow." ATM. Therefore, on the Monday morning, at break of day, the two armies prepared for battle. The English were posted in a strong place, which could only be approached by one narrow lane, skirted by hedges on both sides. The French attacked them by this lane, but were so galled and slain by English arrows from behind the hedges, that they were forced to retreat. Then went 600 English bowmen round about, and, coming upon the rear of the French army, rained arrows on them thick and fast. The French knights, thrown into confusion, quitted their banners and dispersed in all directions. Said Sir John Chandos to the prince, "A ride forward, noble prince, and the day is yours. The King of France is so valiant a gentleman, that I know he will never fly, and may be taken prisoner." ATM. Said the prince to this, "A advance, English banners, in the name of God and St. George." ATM. And on they pressed until they came up with the French king, fighting fiercely with his battle axe, and, when all his nobles had forsaken him, attended faithfully to the last by his youngest son Philip, only 16 years of age. Father and son fought well, and the king had already 2 wounds in his face, and had been beaten down, when he at last delivered himself to a banished French knight, and gave him his right-hand glove in token that he had done so. The Black Prince was generous as well as brave, and he invited his royal prisoner to supper in his tent, and waited upon him at table, and, when they afterwards rode into London in a gorgeous procession, mounted the French king on a fine cream-coloured horse, and rode at his side on a little pony. This was all very kind, but I think it was, perhaps, a little theatrical too, and has been made more meritorious than it deserved to be, especially as I am inclined to think that the greatest kindness to the King of France would have been not to have shown him to the people at all. However, it must be said, for these acts of politeness, that, in course of time, they did much to soften the horrors of war and the passions of conquerors. It was a long, long time before the common soldiers began to have the benefit of such courtly deeds, but they did at last, and thus it is possible that a poor soldier who asked for quarter at the Battle of Waterloo, or any other such great fight, may have owed his life indirectly to Edward the Black Prince. At this time there stood in the Strand, in London, a palace called the Savoy, which was given up to the captive King of France and his son for their residence. As the King of Scotland had now been King Edward ATM's captive for 11 years too, his success was, at this time, tolerably complete. The Scottish business was settled by the prisoner being released under the title of Sir David, King of Scotland, and by his engaging to pay a large ransom. The state of France encouraged England to propose harder terms to that country, where the people rose against the unspeakable cruelty and barbarity of its nobles, where the nobles rose in turn against the people, where the most frightful outrages were committed on all sides, and where the insurrection of the peasants, called the insurrection of the Jacquerie, from Jacques, a common Christian name among the country people of France, awakened terrors and hatreds that have scarcely yet passed away. A treaty called the Great Peace was at last signed, under which King Edward agreed to give up the greater part of his conquests, and King John to pay, within 6 years, a ransom of 3,000,000 crowns of gold. He was so beset by his own nobles and courtiers for having yielded to these conditions, although they could help him to no betterer, that he came back of his own will to his old palace prison of the Savoy, and there died. There was a sovereign of Castile at that time, called Pedro the Cruel, who deserved the name remarkably well, having committed, among other cruelties, a variety of murders. This amiable monarch, being driven from his throne for his crimes, went to the province of Bordeaux, where the Black Prince, now married to his cousin Joan, a pretty widower, was residing, and besought his help. The prince, who took to him much more kindly than a prince of such fame ought to have taken to such ruffian, readily listened to his fair promises, and agreeing to help him, sent secret orders to some troublesome disbanded soldiers of his and his father at EMS, who called themselves the Free Companions, and who had been a pest to the French people, for some time, to aid this Pedro. The prince, himself, going into Spain to head the army of relief, soon set Pedro on his throne again, where he no sooner found himself, than, of course, he behaved like the villain he was, broke his word without the least shame, and abandoned all the promises he had made to the Black Prince. Now, it had cost the prince a good deal of money to pay soldiers to support this murderous king, and finding himself, when he came back disgusted to Bordeaux, not only in bad health, but deeply in debt, he began to tax his French subjects to pay his creditors. They appealed to the French king, Charles. War again broke out, and the French town of Limoges, which the prince had greatly benefited, went over to the French king. Upon this, he ravaged the province of which it was the capital, burnt, and plundered, and killed in the old sickening way, and refused mercy to the prisoners, men, women, and children taken in the offending town, though he was so ill and so much in need of pity himself from heaven, that he was carried in a litter. He lived to come home and make himself popular with the people and parliament, and he died on Trinity Sunday, the 8th of June, 1376, at 46 years old. The whole nation mourned for him as one of the most renowned and beloved princes it had ever had, and he was buried with great lamentations in Canterbury Cathedral, near to the tomb of Edward the Confessor, his monument, with his figure, carved in stone, and represented in the old black armor, lying on its back, may be seen at this day, with an ancient coat of mail, a helmet, and a pair of gauntlets hanging from a beam above it, which most people like to believe were once worn by the Black Prince. King Edward did not outlive his renowned son, long. He was old, and one Alice Berres, a beautiful lady, had contrived to make him so fond of her in his old age, that he could refuse her nothing, and made himself ridiculous. She little deserved his love, or what I dare say she valued a great deal more than the jewels of the late queen, which he gave her among other rich presents. She took the very ring from his finger on the morning of the day when he died, and left him to be pillaged by his faithless servants. Only one good priest was true to him, and attended him to the last. Besides being famous for the great victories I have related, the reign of King Edward III was rendered memorable in better ways, by the growth of architecture and the erection of Windsor Castle. In better ways still, by the rising up of Wycliffe, originally a poor parish priest, who devoted himself to exposing, with wonderful power and success, the ambition and corruption of the Pope, and of the whole church of which he was the head. Some of those Flemings were induced to come to England in this reign too, and to settle in Norfolk, where they made better woolen cloths than the English had ever had before. The Order of the Garter, a very fine thing in its way, but hardly so important as good clothes for the nation, also dates from this period. The king is said to have picked up a lady at EMS Garter at a ball, and to have said, "On y soit qui mal y pense," in English, "A evil be to him who evil thinks of it." ATM The courtiers were usually glad to imitate what the king said or did, and hence from a slight incident the Order of the Garter was instituted, and became a great dignity. So the story goes. Chapter 6 of England under Richard II. Richard, son of the Black Prince, a boy 11 years of age, succeeded to the crown under the title of King Richard II. The whole English nation were ready to admire him for the sake of his brave father. As to the lords and ladies about the court, they declared him to be the most beautiful, the wisest, and the best to even of princes, sir, whom the lords and ladies about the court generally declare to be the most beautiful, the wisest, and the best of mankind. To flatter a poor boy in this base manner was not a very likely way to develop whatever good was in him, and it brought him to anything but a good or happy end. The Duke of Lancaster, the young king at EMS uncle commonly called John of Gaunt, from having been born at Ghent, which the common people so pronounce Eder, was supposed to have some thoughts of the throne himself, but, as he was not popular, and the memory of the Black Prince was, he submitted to his nephew. The war with France being still unsettled, the government of England wanted money to provide for the expenses that might arise out of it. Accordingly, a certain tax, called the poll tax, which had originated in the last reign, was ordered to be levied on the people. This was a tax on every person in the kingdom, male and female, above the age of 14, of 3 groats, or 3 4-penny pieces, a year. Clergymen were charged more, and only beggars were exempt. I have no need to repeat that the common people of England had long been suffering under great oppression. They were still the mere slaves of the lords of the land on which they lived, and were on most occasions harshly and unjustly treated. But, they had begun by this time to think very seriously of not bearing quite so much, and, probably, were emboldened by that French insurrection I mentioned in the last chapter. The people of Essex rose against the poll tax, and being severely handled by the government officers, killed some of them. At this very time, one of the tax collectors, going his rounds from house to house, at Dartford and Kent, came to the cottage of one Watt, a tiler by trade, and claimed the tax upon his daughter. Her mother, who was at home, declared that she was under the age of 14. Upon that, the collector, as other collectors had already done in different parts of England, behaved in a savage way, and brutally insulted Watt Tyler at TMS daughter. The daughter screamed, the mother screamed. Watt the tiler, who was at work not far off, ran to the spot, and did what any honest father under such provocation might have done, struck the collector dead at a blow. Instantly the people of that town uprose as one man. They made Watt Tyler their leader. They joined with the people of Essex, who were in arms under a priest called Jack Straw. They took out of prison another priest named John Ball, and gathering in numbers as they went along, advanced, in a great confused army of poor men, to Blackheath. It is said that they wanted to abolish all property, and to declare all men equal. I do not think this very likely, because they stopped the travellers on the roads and made them swear to be true to King Richard and the people. Nor were they at all disposed to injure those who had done them no harm, merely because they were of high station, for, the King of TMS mother, who had to pass through their camp at Blackheath, on her way to her young son, lying for safety in the Tower of London, had merely to kiss a few dirty-faced rough-bearded men who were noisily fond of royalty, and so got away in perfect safety. Next day the whole mass marched on to London Bridge. There was a drawbridge in the middle, which William Walworth the mayor caused to be raised to prevent their coming into the city, but they soon terrified the citizens into lowering it again, and spread themselves, with great uproar, over the streets. They broke open the prisons, they burned the papers in Lambeth Palace, they destroyed the Duke of Lancaster at TMS Palace, the Savoy, in the Strand, said to be the most beautiful and splendid in England. They set fire to the books and documents in the temple, and made a great riot. Many of these outrages were committed in drunkenness, since those citizens, who had well-filled cellars, were only too glad to throw them open to save the rest of their property, but even the drunken rioters were very careful to steal nothing. They were so angry with one man, who was seen to take a silver cup at the Savoy Palace, and put it in his breast, that they drowned him in the river, cup and all. The young king had been taken out to treat with them before they committed these excesses, but, he and the people about him were so frightened by the riotous shouts, that they got back to the tower in the best way they could. This made the insurgents bolder, so they went on rioting away, striking off the heads of those who did not, at a moment at TMS notice, declare for King Richard and the people, and killing as many of the unpopular persons whom they supposed to be their enemies as they could by any means lay hold of. In this manner they passed one very violent day, and then proclamation was made that the king would meet them at Mile End, and grant their requests. The rioters went to Mile End to the number of 60,000, and the king met them there, and to the king the rioters peaceably proposed 4 conditions. First, that neither they, nor their children, nor any coming after them, should be made slaves any more. Secondly, that the rent of land should be fixed at a certain price in money, instead of being paid in service. Thirdly, that they should have liberty to buy and sell in all markets and public places, like other free men. Fourthly, that they should be pardoned for past offences. Heaven knows, there was nothing very unreasonable in these proposals. The young king deceitfully pretended to think so, and kept 30 clerks up, all night, writing out a charter accordingly. Now, what Tyler himself wanted more than this? He wanted the entire abolition of the forest laws. He was not at Mile End with the rest, but, while that meeting was being held, broke into the Tower of London and slew the Archbishop and the Treasurer, for whose heads the people had cried out loudly the day before. He and his men even thrust their swords into the bed of the Princess of Wales while the Princess was in it, to make certain that none of their enemies were concealed there. So, Wat and his men still continued armed, and rode about the city. Next morning, the king with a small train of some 60 gentlemen, among whom was Walworth the Mayor, rode into Smithfield, and saw Wat and his people at a little distance. Says Wat to his men, "Hey, there is the king. I will go speak with him, and tell him what we want." ATM, straightway Wat rode up to him, and began to talk. "Hey, king." ATM, says Wat, "Hey, dost thou see all my men there?" ATM, "Ar." ATM, says the king. "A why?" ATM, "A because." ATM, says Wat, "A they are all at my command, and have sworn to do whatever I bid them." ATM, some declared afterwards that as Wat said this, he laid his hand on the king ATM's bridle. Others declared that he was seen to play with his own dagger. I think, myself, that he just spoke to the king like a rough, angry man as he was, and did nothing more. At any rate, he was expecting no attack, and preparing for no resistance, when Walworth the Mayor did the not very valiant deed of drawing a short sword and stabbing him in the throat. He dropped from his horse, and one of the King OTM's people speedily finished him. So fell Wat Tyler. Fawners and flatterers made a mighty triumph of it, and set up a cry which will occasionally find an echo to this day. But Wat was a hard-working man, who had suffered much, and had been foully outraged, and it is probable that he was a man of a much higher nature and a much braver spirit than any of the parasites who exulted then, or have exulted since, over his defeat. Seeing Wat down, his men immediately bent their bows to avenge his fall. If the young king had not had presence of mind at that dangerous moment, both he and the mayor to boot, might have followed Tyler pretty fast. But the king, riding up to the crowd, cried out that Tyler was a traitor, and that he would be their leader. They were so taken by surprise, that they set up a great shouting, and followed the boy until he was met at Islington by a large body of soldiers. The end of this rising was the then usual end. As soon as the king found himself safe, he unsaid all he had said, and undid all he had done. Some 1,500 of the rioters were tried, mostly in Essex, with great rigour, and executed with great cruelty. Many of them were hanged on gibbets, and left there as a terror to the country people, and, because their miserable friends took some of the bodies down to bury, the king ordered the rest to be chained up, which was the beginning of the barbarous custom of hanging in chains. The King OTM's falsehood in this business makes such a pitiful figure, that I think Wat Tyler appears in history as beyond comparison the truer and more respectable man of the two. Richard was now 16 years of age, and married Anne of Bohemia, an excellent princess, who was called the Good Queen Anne.ATM. She deserved a better husband, for the king had been fawned and flattered into a treacherous, wasteful, dissolute, bad young man. There were two popes at this time, as if one were not enough, and their quarrels involved Europe in a great deal of trouble. Scotland was still troublesome too, and at home there was much jealousy and distrust, and plotting and counterplotting, because the king feared the ambition of his relations, and particularly of his uncle, the Duke of Lancaster, and the Duke had his party against the king, and the king had his party against the Duke. Nor were these home troubles lessened when the Duke went to Castile to urge his claim to the crown of that kingdom, for then the Duke of Gloucester, another of Richard OTM's uncles, opposed him, and influenced the Parliament to demand the dismissal of the King OTM's favourite ministers. The King said in reply, that he would not for such men dismiss the meanest servant in his kitchen. But, It had begun to signify little what a king said when a parliament was determined, so Richard was at last obliged to give way, and to agree to another government of the kingdom, under a commission of 40 nobles, for a year. His uncle of Gloucester was at the head of this commission, and, in fact, appointed everybody composing it,